WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. This is Ed James III with your WSLR News headlines for Friday, August 28th. In breaking regional sports news, the Tampa Bay City Council has voted to approve a development agreement for a new $2.3 billion stadium for the Tampa Bay Rays. As reported by WUSF, the approval moves the long-debated project forward, leaving the Hillsborough County Commission to make the final funding decision today. If approved by the county, the deal will secure a new permanent home for the Major League Baseball franchise on the Dale Mabry campus of Hillsborough Community College across the street from Raymond James Stadium. Sarasota County Commissioners have approved this year's local arts grant without engaging in debate over diversity, equity, and inclusion policies. However, as reported by ArtBeat and Suncoast Searchlight, the Urbanite Theater was left off the funding list after it declined to sign an acknowledgement of new DEI restrictions. The decision leaves the Downtown Sarasota Theater Group without county grant support for its upcoming season, while dozens of other local arts organizations receive funding approval under the county's Tourist Development Tax Grant program. Manatee County has finalized a new ordinance designed to shut down local commercial gaming facilities and adult arcades. According to reporting by Suncoast Searchlight, the County Commission voted to establish stricter zoning and operating restrictions on electronic game rooms. County officials state the ordinance aims to address public safety concerns, effectively phasing out existing casino-style operations in unincorporated Manatee County. Tourism numbers present a mixed picture across the state, with Sarasota County outperforming broader Florida trends. According to reports from CBS News and the Sarasota Herald Tribune, statewide tourism has experienced a slight decline due in part to a drop in Canadian visitors. However, Sarasota County reported a surge in summer tourism, with visitor spending nearing $146 million as local arts, beaches, and cultural attractions continue to draw travelers. Finally, local environmental group Sarasota Baywatch is inviting volunteers to participate in its 2026 monofilament cleanup on Saturday, September 19th. The annual event targets discarded fishing lines, hooks, and lures along shorelines, bridges, and jetties to protect seabirds and marine life from entanglement. Volunteers can participate by boat, kayak, or on foot with the Sarasota Sailing Squadron serving as event headquarters. Registration is open at sarasotabaywatch.org. This has been Ed James III with your WSLR News headlines for Friday, August 28th.
The program was pre-recorded in front of an audience of one real live cat. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, who at the music and arts venue Fogartyville provide a center for creative expression and community engagement that amplifies the voices of our diverse community and promotes peace, sustainability, democracy, and economic and social justice. I am Lou Larini. Thanks for tuning in to Surreal News, where we offer opinions, comments, and perspective on the events of the week, which do not necessarily represent the station, its board, or anyone else other than the person who expressed them. As costs continue to rise for American consumers, the mango Mussolini continues to spend like a drunken sailor on leave after spending 250 days at sea without a port call. Well, maybe those sailors from the USS Lincoln who are finally heading to port will perhaps be a bit more practical than the idiom suggests. From reports of life aboard ship, it seems stocking up on toothpaste and soap as well as getting a good meal will be likely the first expenditures. I doubt any of them will be visiting, let alone building any grand ballrooms at taxpayer expense. And oh yeah, it was recently revealed that the so-called critical military value of the new ballroom, a hardened bunker, is not necessary because, as I'm sure must rankle the grifter-in-chief, it was already built by none other than Barack Obama. Stay tuned until half past the hour to hear my conversation with Tom Bergen, Director of Voter Engagement for Headcount, a nonpartisan organization who register young voters mainly at concerts and festivals and will be at work for the next 30 days at the Harry Styles Madison Square Garden residency. But first, hear about the latest efforts of the president and the president narcissus to brand all things natural and man-made, as well as the costs of these excesses to us all. President Donald Trump this week escalated his feud with Canadian leaders, suggesting the United States is considering renaming Lake Ontario to Lake America, as tensions between the two countries rise amid an ongoing trade war. The United States is giving serious consideration to changing the name of Lake Ontario to Lake America, in that we don't expect to be doing much business with Ontario any longer. Thank you for your attention to this matter, Trump wrote in Truth Social Post. In a subsequent post, the president posted an image of a map with Lake Ontario crossed out and the words Lake America spelled out in gold lettering with an American flag. Minister for Canada-U.S. Trade Dominic LeBlanc declined to comment on Trump's first post, telling CNBC, "We've decided as federal government months ago not to respond to this sort of daily social media posts of either the president or his cabinet secretary. We're focused on doing what we can in Canada to build our economy and to have a constructive relationship with the government of the United States, our most important trading partner," LeBlanc added. Lake Ontario is the smallest of the five Great Lakes by surface area, separating the state of New York from Ontario, Canada. Trump's Lake America jab comes a day after he warned Canada of far worse consequences if its leaders do not fall in line following the collapse of trade talks between the two countries. It's also not the first time the U.S. president has tried to rename a body of water, adding America, having previously signed the order trying to change the name of the Gulf of Mexico. Trump ramped up insults, declaring Canada entitled and unreasonable in another Truth Social post, a sign the escalating trade war isn't waning. "I deal with many countries, and Canada is easily the most difficult and unreasonable," he wrote. "They feel entitled, but they're not a state, and they will be entitled no longer." He said Canada had been ripping off the U.S. for decades and claimed Canadian trade policies have driven many wonderful U.S. companies out of business. He cited trade barriers on Gulfstream jets, though Gulfstream company has not gone out of business. Trump has repeatedly criticized Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney and Ontario Premier Doug Ford, accusing Canada of taking advantage of the U.S. for decades. Lots of bluster from Doug Ford, who is the Premier of Canada province of Ontario, but who is better known as the less charismatic, intelligent, and overall unimpressive brother of the late, great Rob Ford, Trump wrote. The dispute comes as Trump threatened on Monday to increase tariffs on Canadian cars, trucks, and automotive parts and steel to 50% beginning January 1st, 2026. Canada has vowed to respond with dollar-to-dollar tariffs beginning September 8th. Doesn't this administration have more important things to do than renaming a performing arts center? The court fight has rekindled over the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts after the board voted that President Donald Trump's name must go on, even if the show doesn't for a few years of construction. U.S. District Judge Christopher Cooper had ordered Trump's name removed from the building's facade in May because Congress hadn't authorized it. Cooper also blocked the administration from closing the venue for 2 years of construction because of the plans for the project were adopted too hastily. But the Kennedy name has remained obscured by scaffolding and tarps and as litigation grinds on. The board, stacked with Trump allies, voted August 13th to restore its name to the facade twice. So, Rep. Joyce Beatty Democrat from Ohio, asked Cooper in an emergency request on August 20th to block the last renaming. "It's deja vu all over again," said Beatty, who serves on the Kennedy Center board. Updates in the court battle offered some behind-the-scenes details about the renovation project for which Congress appropriated $257 million. The curtain could go up on another court hearing before September 8th, the deadline the board set for effectuating its decision to rename the building. The board decided to close the Kennedy Center during construction, which became a point of contention in the lawsuit. But Charles Matthew Flocka, the center's executive director and chief operating officer, said a consultant estimated that a partial closure would nearly double the cost of the time frame for the project. Delta Consulting Group told the board at an August 13th meeting that if construction partially closed the venue, it would require 4 years of revolving closures on the main level of the building and cost an estimated $580 million. Closing the building entirely for 2 years, which the board approved, would cost $285 million. The board also agreed to restore Trump's name to the facade. They voted to rename the building the John F. Kennedy Memorial Center for the Performing Arts, restored and renovated by President Donald Trump. And if Trump's fundraising for the project reaches $100 million, the facade would read, "The John F. Kennedy Memorial Center for the Performing Arts, restored and renovated by President Donald S. Trump, endowed by the Trump Kennedy Center Fund." The board also voted to name the grounds beneath the venue President Donald J. Trump Plaza. Beatty argued that the renaming violated the constitutional statute that created the center in 1964 and Cooper's order. Scaffolding and tarp continue to block the view of Kennedy's name after Trump's name was removed on June 13th. The Kennedy Center manager said scaffolding was required for water testing and structural repairs to the roof overhanging the front portico. The scaffolding also serves as a safety barrier for construction and to safeguard the marble facade of the building from reported damage. But Beatty argued that the underside of the roof eaves are 20 feet above the scaffolding and that the scaffolding hasn't been erected around the rest of the marble building to protect it or examine other parts of the roof. "Enough is enough," Beatty's filing said. "Defendants' contemptuous behavior must stop." You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Just what does $40 trillion in debt get you? Investors are demanding a higher return to lend to the U.S. government. Several things are behind the recent rise in long-term bond yields, including sticky inflation and a less predictable Federal Reserve. But worries about America's finances are also a factor. Total public debt outstanding officially passed the $40 trillion mark last week. Moves in the bond market influenced the price of home loans, which tracked the 10-year Treasury yield. The rate on the 30-year mortgage has been above 6.6% for most of August. Expensive mortgages are making it harder to get housing deals done. Existing home sales fell 1.7% in July over the previous month. Tuesday's release of sales for new homes in July was expected to continue showing a sluggish market. That probably won't change anytime soon. The combination of high home values and costlier mortgages could keep America's housing market in a deep freeze for a fourth year in a row. At today's rates, buyers with a 20% down payment need slightly more than $100,000 to qualify for a mortgage and will spend 24.2% of their gross income to service the principal and interest on a median-priced home, data from the National Association of Realtors shows. Earlier this year, mortgage rates briefly dipped below 6% for the first time since 2022, easing the burden of buying a home. Turmoil in bond markets is unpicking the improvements in affordability. An analysis by the Conference Board think tank shows why a family of four that is currently saving for a 20% down payment to buy a $600,000 house in 5 years has an interest in seeing public debt come down. The federal budget deficit is expected to reach 2.1 trillion in fiscal year 2026, or around 6% of gross domestic product, according to the Congressional Budget Office. If the government reduced the deficit to 3% of GDP over the next decade, and financial markets reward this healthier financial outlook with lower interest rates, the family of four would pay $12,000 less over the lifetime of a 30-year mortgage. If the deficit rises to 9%, they could face an extra $13,000 in costs. Unaffordable housing, it doesn't only hurt buyers. U.S. housing construction fell sharply in July as rising mortgage rates are denting builder confidence. Builders like Lennar and Pulte Group were optimistic earlier this year that they might finally be able to reduce profit-sapping incentives like mortgage rate buy-downs. With rates increasing again, builders will likely need to continue with those sweeteners. The physical shortage of housing gets a lot of the blame in the debate about how to tackle America's affordability problem. The national debt pile deserves attention, too. Apparently, the claim to be decimated Iranian military still has some ammo. Iran has inflicted billions of dollars in damage on U.S. forces in the Middle East at a never-before-seen scale, according to insiders. And the latest leak, likely to provide a headache for the porous Trump administration, four people with knowledge of the situation told NBC News that U.S. intelligence stations around the Middle East have been crippled. This despite President Donald Trump's continued insistence that the U.S. has destroyed Tehran's military might. Intelligence posts and surveillance hardware in the region, some of which is shared with military spans a dozen countries, have been depleted by drones and missile strikes, they said. The insiders said the level of damage is unprecedented, with repair costs soaring into the billions. An Iranian drone barrage slammed into the CIA station in Saudi Arabian capital of Riyadh. Foreign operatives also targeted a secondary American intelligence facility situated in eastern Iraq, pummeling key intelligence assets early in the conflict. Iran has launched more than 2,000 missiles, drones, and airstrikes during the war, hitting at least 20 U.S. government sites across 8 countries. These strikes were added by satellite surveillance imagery handed over from Russia and China, as well as electronic intelligence from Vladimir Putin's regime. The Iranian strikes have forced Congress to scramble for funding to patch up facilities. Two sources told NBC News that officials have mulled over a change of attack to address the threat. Military experts, former U.S. officials who have been left scratching their heads at why the Defense Department and intelligence community and State Department were not ready for this kind of response from Iran and are following unprecedented destruction. NBC News suggested that the CIA and other intelligence agencies were shocked by the size and aerial effort from the Iranians. It reported that the agencies had not seen such a violent response from the skies in decades. Despite the aerial onslaught, insiders insist that the intelligence effort in the region is unharmed. But some experts aren't convinced. The U.S. walked into this war and it had not sufficiently thought through base defense in any way, shape, or form. Seth Jones, president of the Defense and Security Department at the Center for Strategic International Studies think tank, said, and we got hammered. A Pentagon spokesperson said it does not comment on intelligence-related matters as a matter of practice. Now the federal government is offering school vouchers, turning a Florida grift into a national scam. President Donald Trump and U.S. Education Secretary Linda McMahon this week touted a national private school voucher program set to launch in early 2027. During a White House Rose Garden event celebrating the back-to-school season, Trump and McMahon lauded the incoming federal school choice effort, along with many of the education policies the administration has pursued, including ongoing efforts to dismantle the 46-year-old education department. At least 30 states have already opted in to school voucher program, which allocates up to $1,700 in federal tax credits for people donating to organizations that provide private and religious school scholarships. The program, known as Education Freedom Tax Credit, was created in the GOP's mega tax and spending cut bill Trump signed into law in July 2025. 1 year ago, as part of the Great Big Beautiful Bill, we passed the Education Freedom Tax Credit, the largest ever expansion of school choice, and we want every parent to have the power to send their child to a high-quality school that shares their values, Trump told the crowd of educators, parents, and students. The event highlighted Trump and congressional Republicans' continued focus on school choice as a central point of their education agenda, and the upcoming voucher program marking a pillar of that effort. The umbrella term school choice centers on alternative programs to a student's assigned public school, while opponents argue that these efforts drain critical funds and resources from school districts. Advocates say the initiatives are necessary for parents dissatisfied with their local public schools. Attendees at the Rose Garden also included Republican governors Jim Pillen of Nebraska and Sarah Huckabee Sanders of Arkansas, as well as GOP Rep. Tim Walberg of Michigan, who chairs the House Committee on Education and Workforce. McMahon echoed the president, saying the federal program gives parents unprecedented freedom to choose the path that is best for their children. She added that it's no surprise that over half of our nation's states, both red and blue, have raced to the historic choice option benefiting families, whether their child attends public or private school. Meanwhile, congressional Democrats are already attempting to axe the program. Senators Mark Kelly of Arizona and Mazie Hirono of Hawaii in April introduced a bill in the Senate alongside nearly 30 of their colleagues that would repeal the program. Rep. Gwen Moore of Wisconsin introduced a companion bill in the House in June with Reps. Suzanne Bonamici of Oregon and Maxwell Frost of Florida, Adela Gravera of Arizona, and Mark Pocan of Wisconsin, and dozens more original co-sponsors. The legislation faces dismal fate in the GOP-controlled House and Senate. Florida ranchers are not happy with the plan to drop tariffs on ground beef. Florida's cattle ranchers are criticizing President Donald Trump's move to import 300,000 tons of tariff-free beef to lower prices for consumers. Blaming President Joe Biden for increased prices, Trump announced the deal on social media on Friday, saying it would drop the cost of beef to 25% below current market prices. This deal will reduce prices for Americans while giving space for our great American beef herd to grow again, Trump wrote on Truth Social. But Florida's cattle ranchers and ranchers across the country are disappointed, said Colin Woodall, CEO of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. The Florida Cattlemen's Association agrees. Artificially interfering with the cattle market is not sound policy, especially when producers continue to face record high prices for many of the inputs required to raise cattle, said the group's president, John Williamson. Strong markets are encouraging cattlemen to rebuild their herds, and government intervention that disrupts those market signals threatens both producer confidence and the long-term stability of America's beef supply. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, beef and veal prices are expected to increase 10.7% this year. This past April, the average retail price for beef set a record high at $9.64 a pound, up about 13% from 2025. Excessive drought across the country, the COVID-19 pandemic, and increased operating costs have dwindled the U.S. cattle herd to a 75-year low after pushing farmers to liquidate their herds, according to the Federal Farm Bureau Federation. In Florida this year, the state battled the harshest drought in decades, with approximately 80% of the state facing extreme conditions in April, according to the U.S. Drought Monitor. Florida currently ranks 9th in the country for beef production, according to the annual Florida Cattle Market Report. In January of this year, the average price for a calf in Florida was 59% higher compared to last year and 76% higher than in 2024. When asked for a comment, Agricultural Commissioner Wilton Simpson, who's running for a second term and has been endorsed by Trump, said the best response is to promote the Fresh from Florida program, which markets Sunshine State produce. Our brand awareness and sales are as high as they've ever been, Simpson said. We know now it is important for our Florida farmers and cattlemen are. We will continue to do all we can to help them. I encourage anyone to buy local Fresh from Florida products to support our farmers. TaxWatch is offering unbiased info on the expected effects of Amendment 3. Floridians weighing the pros and cons of November's property tax ballot item will be able to rely on Florida TaxWatch's new website for one informed perspective. The Florida Property Tax Resource Center offers what the group calls independent data-driven research to make informed decisions related to Amendment 3. The ballot measure, which requires 60% support to pass, would raise homestead exemptions to $250,000 by 2028. The organization, which is dedicated to fiscal discipline, notes on its splash page the hard choices it would impose on local governments closest to the voters and their immediate needs. Amendment 3 would cut local property taxes by an estimated $45.8 billion over 5 years, the website warns. TaxWatch also provides a county-by-county impacts on a graphical map, including ranking of the fiscal impacts per county. Our Property Tax Resource Center provides legislators, policymakers, voters, and members of the media with unbiased and nonpartisan information regarding how this measure impacts Florida homeowners and their local governments, said Chair David Casey. Florida Tax Watch President and CEO Jeff Kottkamp, a former lieutenant governor, said some voters may be unclear what they are voting on. While Tax Watch wants property tax reform, it believes the current product was rushed through and that the proper mechanism would be for Florida Taxation and Budget Review Commission. That group meets every 20 years, but will come together next year. Republican gubernatorial candidate Byron Donalds said he will urge the panel to consider property tax changes, even if the current proposal falls short in November. The Tax Watch microsite comes just as Attorney General James Uthmeer created a court-ordered revision of ballot language to remove sloganeering promotion of the proposal. Ironically, a survey from Sachs Media shows that voters liked the new product more. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Up next is my interview with Tom Bergen, Director of Voter Engagement at Headcount.
I'm Lou Larini, and I'm pleased to welcome Tom Bergen, Director of Voter Engagement at Headcount, which is a national nonpartisan organization that uses the power of music, culture, and community to turn fans into voters. We meet young people where they already are, at concerts, festivals, and online, to make it easier to vote, and to learn about elections and to take action. Is that about right, Tom?
Yeah, that I would say that is the core of what we do.
Hey, thanks. I want to thank you, though, for making time for us today and just, tell me how you got involved with this group that I understand has been registering voters at concerts since 2004.
Yeah, absolutely. So Headcount was founded in 2004, and I found my way to the organization in 2015. I was a college student living in St. Louis, Missouri. And I wanted two things. One, to go to more concerts with a limited fixed income I had as a college student. But two, to find a volunteer opportunity that felt like it really mattered and felt like I was walking away from doing a volunteer shift and being like, wow, I did something positive today. And Headcount unbelievably filled both of those things that I was really hoping for. And it was really the best of both worlds of finding a place where I felt like my time and energy was valued and I was making a difference and I was actively helping people learn about elections and figure out what they needed and all of these kind of pieces of the puzzle that are a part of being a voting, being a voter. And
Yeah, I just got to ask, did you first register to vote with Headcount, or were you already registered to vote and involved in our democracy?
No, I was registered to vote already, but I had not yet voted in an election because I had recently turned 18. So I got involved with Headcount kind of right as my civic journey began.
Great. Interesting. Go on. I'm sorry I interrupted.
Yeah, no worries. But so I was a volunteer in St. Louis, Missouri for about 3.5 years. And then I was a volunteer in Louisville, Kentucky, which is where I did my graduate studies for 2 years. And then I joined on the Headcount team full time about 4.5 years ago in the Department of Voter Engagement. And so it's been really amazing. My career before this was I was a elementary school educator. And so getting to kind of use those tools in the voter engagement department where I'm constantly thinking about how can we educate our volunteers, our staff members, our people that we're interacting with at a show or an event, how can we bring them up the level of education and engagement just a smidge every time that we're chatting with them. And that's really what I seek to do in my role now.
Great. This isn't totally relevant, but I'm just curious. How many concerts do you go to a year?
Oh, my goodness. Probably somewhere around 80 to 100.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yes, there's a lot of good concerts out there. I'm a little older than you, but, we love live music and go see a lot of it. First off, though, I want to thank you and everyone at Headcount for, making this effort to get young people involved in the political system that, whether they realize it or not, is the key to their future. This upcoming election, like it seems many of our most recent elections, is the most important of our lifetimes. Is Headcount feeling that vibe from young people that they're encountering this year or this election cycle, I guess?
I think that yes, there is an energy and excitement to vote from young people, but also it's really tiring as young people for every single election to be billed as the most important election of their lifetime. My first election as a voter was, my first federal election was 2016, and every election since then has been the most important election of our lifetime, and it's really difficult to inspire young people to feel like there is kind of meaningful change at stake when that big bill is given every single time that there's an election. Even if it is true, which it very well might be, it's hard sometimes to get people to buy into that narrative. So we instead try to look at what other narratives we can work with to inspire and engage young people. And those are talking to them about the issues that they care about, as opposed to kind of like the bigger picture of like, you got to get out and vote. It's your civic duty. It's like, well, what do you care about? What issues are impacting you as a 20-year-old college student living in Missouri or a 24-year-old young professional living in California? Like, we want to hear what issues you're thinking about, what issues are impacting your day-to-day life, and let's talk about how that's going to present itself on the ballot. And I think that that is in the kind of fatigue of the national narrative being like, you got to get out and vote. This is the most important election of our lifetime. That kind of micro engagement of what is it that is specifically impacting you is really, really important and valuable to young people.
Yeah, I think that is a great way to look at it. I, of course, have had a little more experience voting than you, considering, you know, the first federal election I voted in was for George McGovern back in 1972. And I do have to say, though, that since that 2016 election, you know, while, you know, there have been elections before where everybody said, you know, this is the most important election of our lifetime or whatever, you know, there was never as stark a difference or it seemed like urgency, you know, for a lot of us since 2016. And we won't name any names. According to your website, though, Headcount has registered, you know, nearly 2 million voters. I guess at least, I mean, the number that I saw was like 1.8 or something, but that was a count from like 2024. So I'm saying you got to be up around getting close to 2 million. In the past, though, according to a report on your site in the last midterm in 2022, produced fewer registrations than the previous year. How's it going this year? Is it up? Is it down? Is it average?
Yeah, so we don't do full reporting until after the cycle, but I would say that our goals are ambitious to get our voter registration numbers the highest they've ever been for a midterm and also hopefully see our universe of contacts turn out and vote in kind of like the highest numbers that we've ever seen for midterm elections. And I think that one thing that I think that that kind of cultural shift of people realizing and understanding that there are really, really important elections that are taking place not when there's a president on the ballot is something that even, again, as putting my personal hat on as Tom the voter, not Tom the person who works in voting, seeing that change over the last 10 years has been really positive and really inspiring. So our hope is to see record turnout this year and record young voter turnout and to see the numbers that always happen with a drop-off from the presidential to the midterms be significantly lessened than what they are in previous cycles. So that's kind of where we're at right now. But anecdotally, things are going great. People are really, really excited to see us at the events that we're at. We're working with a lot of great artists and partners. Tomorrow kicks off 30 days of working or 30 concerts with Harry Styles at Madison Square Garden, where we will be at every single one engaging with his fans. And that's just one of a number of projects that we're working on right now that we're, like, so excited about.
Yeah, we'll talk more about them in a minute. But I'm just curious, you know, what's the principal demographic group Headcount registers? You know, it shows it's, like, 18 to 34. Does that sort of hold true?
Yeah, I would say 18 to 34 is definitely our target demographic. It's our biggest demographic, and it's who we seek out to be in places where they're going to be.
You know, registering an 18-year-old who just became eligible to vote would be common, would be their first time. How often is Headcount registering older voters for the first time? Do you have any data on that?
Hard numbers, no, but I can tell you that we do still have a significant amount of people who are older voters that are engaging with Headcount in a number of ways. And so that's going to be one of a few things. One is they're going to be updating their voter registration status, which is something that someone has to do for a handful of reasons. One, they may be moved. So while it is true that people who are older move at lower rates than people who are younger, who are, you know, changing apartments every 12 to 18 months, people still move all the time throughout their entire lives. And so every time they move, they have to update their voter registration, even if it's in the same building and to a different apartment number or down the street. they have to update their voter registration. So we're there to assist with that process. But we also are there to assist with a number of other things, including party declaration and affiliation changes. So if someone is registered with a political party and they would like to change to being a independent voter or vice versa, they are an independent voter and they would like to register or affiliate with a political party, we can help them do that. If they've had a legal name change from a marriage or a divorce or any other reason why they may be changing their name, we assist with that. So there's a number of reasons why someone who is not a first-time voter still is going to need to register to vote with us. And some of our biggest artist partners have fan bases that are significantly older than the 18 to 34 demographic. I mean, for almost the entirety of our organization's existence, we had worked with Bob Weir, who passed away earlier this year, who was a family member of the Grateful Dead. He was on tour pretty much the entire time since 2004 until his passing, and we were at almost every single one of his shows. And there are some young people, but there's not a ton of young people at Grateful Dead shows. And same is true for a number of our other partners. And so we kind of cater to the audiences that we're working with. We know that different audiences have different needs, and we, as kind of the volunteers and the people bringing the voter registration forms to these spaces, want to always make sure that we are bringing what folks are going to need to those spaces.
Okay. You know, I just want to interrupt for a second and remind people just tuning in, this is WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. And I'm speaking with Tom Bergen, who is Director of Voter Engagement with Headcount. Yeah, that was a great point, you know, about how, you know, people's registrations do change. And also the laws around registrations have changed. I know here in Florida, you know, they make it particularly difficult or have tried to, you know, to make third party registrars of voters, you know, a little more difficult than it needed to be. Do you guys run into that problem elsewhere or even in Florida, and how do you work with that?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a really great legal team that we work with directly, where anytime there is a change in law that might impact a third-party voter registration organization like Headcount, we consult with them to figure out what is going to be necessary in order for us to continue to do the work. And most of the times, there's just some sort of barrier that needs to be addressed, and then we're able to continue to do our work. But sometimes we have to cease doing our operations in a place that we normally are active in. And so I would say the most pressing example of that in recent memory is that a recent law was passed that no longer allows for third-party voter registration at citizenship ceremonies. And so we used to be one of many voting organizations who would show up. People would become citizens, and we would be there and say, you're a citizen, let's register you to vote. And that is now under the operation of other federal government entities, and third-party organizations are not invited to those ceremonies anymore. So it is a bummer that sometimes laws are passed that make it difficult for us to do the work that we want to do, because at the end of the day, our ethos is we are seeking to answer the call of, if there is a need for voter registration, we want to be there. And it's always very upsetting when laws are passed on the state or federal level where that is preventing us from doing that.
True that, actually, if there are any laws made around voting, it should be to try to make it easier for people to vote, not harder, you know, and in some parts of the country, you know, particularly here in Florida, sometimes it seems like, you know, they want to make it a little more difficult for certain people to vote, and I was just wondering if that is impacting your business or your efforts, your activities. Which artists' concerts have proven to be most successful for you, you know, who I guess are partners with Headcount?
Yeah, I would say that our biggest and most successful partners are the big pop artists. So like I said earlier, tomorrow we're kicking off a 30-night run with Harry Styles, and we anticipate engaging thousands and thousands of young voters across those 30 nights. Similarly, this weekend we will be at the Daisy Chain Fields Music Festival out in Irvine, California, and that is a first-time festival being put on by Olivia Rodrigo, who has really championed the work that we do and the work of many other nonprofit organizations. Billie Eilish, Sabrina Carpenter, the list goes on, but the big names in pop music right now who want to have us out at their shows are the ones where we see the greatest numbers of success, because their fan bases are such where if you have a co-sign from that artist and you say, hey, we're Headcount, we're here at the request of Harry Styles and his team, and we're registering voters, they say, say less. What can I do? How can I sign up? What can I do to support you? Because they are so locked into being fans of their artist, and they know that if this artist that they love is endorsing something and is giving space for an organization, that they also want to be supporting it, which is just like the greatest feeling. It's such awesome and positive energy, and it's a joy to be a volunteer and to be at the booth for a show like that. In July, I had the pleasure of working a Ariana Grande show, and her crowd was just absolutely magnificent, and they like already knew. They were like, we want to find the Headcount booth. We want to find you guys. We want to register to vote so we can say for the rest of our lives that we registered to vote at an Ariana Grande show. And so while we have hundreds of artist partners and we love every single one of them, it's those really big marquee A-list pop stars that we see insane levels of engagement out of a single concert.
That's great, and they are really big and important, and I don't want to diminish their value, but I got to ask, you know, I know it would have been on your website if it existed. You weren't there at Tay-Tay's Eras Tour?
No, we were not a partner of the Eras Tour.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Her heart's still in the right place. Okay. All right, but there's other stuff you do, you know, to try to get people interested. This Good to Vote campaigns, I guess, that use like a sweepstakes model. Those look kind of cool.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Good to Vote campaign is something that kind of came out of the pandemic era of tinkering and figuring out what we could do to engage people in the digital realm, because we were not physically at concerts. And what we came up with was, people are really interested in one-of-a-kind experiences or opportunities to win something that's really amazing. And we have all these incredible partners who have the opportunity to offer up something amazing. And so we just kind of connected the dots and said, let's go ahead and do something with this, and created the Good to Vote model, which essentially offers someone an opportunity to win a really cool sweepstakes, whether it's a flyaway to see one of our artist partners, or it is limited early access to a track that an artist released. They have the opportunity to win these things for checking their voter registration status. And this is really important for a number of reasons. So it is illegal to incentivize voting and registering to vote, as has always been the case and is a very well-documented law. And so we're never asking someone, hey, register to vote to win this thing. We're saying, we just want you to check. And that's really helpful, especially for young people who are moving a lot, to say, okay, let me check my voter registration status and get something out of it and be entered into this sweepstakes. And maybe it's going to come back and say, like, hey, Tom, we couldn't find you in our records as being registered to vote at your current address. Do you want to register to vote right now? And then you can talk to a Headcount representative at the concert or event and say, hey, it came back that it said that I wasn't registered. And we can kind of parse through and say, okay, well, let's get you registered and figure out where they live, if they've moved recently, and ultimately get them ready to vote for their upcoming election. But it's a really great model. We can run it digitally and in the field, so it's something that we can use and promote on social media as well as in person, which is really wonderful, because it extends our reach and who we're able to speak to. And yeah, it's just it's another tool in our toolbox for engaging voters and getting people excited about elections.
Yeah. You know, where else does Headcount go besides concerts, you know, to find people to register?
Anywhere where people will have us. So we do concerts and music festivals are our bread and butter, but we also go to community events. That could be everything from a Pride event to a Juneteenth event to a farmer's market to a weird niche festival that happens only in your community. And you're like, it's the Tomato Fest. Everybody loves the Tomato Fest. And so really it's wherever there is a need for voter registration and we have the volunteer base to be able to provide that voter registration, we like to be at. And so it's really expanded from when we started, which we were just at concerts and festivals. Now we're really staples of a community in the cities where we are active, and we love to show up anywhere and everywhere, whether it's a school, community festival, music festival, or anything in between.
Okay, well, you know, as anybody who's been involved in campaigns know, you know, as important as getting people registered to is get out to vote actions, you know, and I guess you guys are involved in get out to vote activities too.
Yeah, absolutely. So as soon as someone enters into our universe and gives us either their email or their phone number, we have a whole plan where we reach out to them a number of times between that moment and election day to kind of walk them through the process of here are your options for voting and here is where your polling place is and here is if you live in a state that requires ID to vote, here is what you need to bring to vote. And we like to really walk people through the process, and that's the same when we're out at events. Really starting on September 1st, we're kind of changing our model from not only just asking people, are you registered to vote, but we're asking what's your plan to vote and how do you plan to vote and do you have questions about the voting process? And we're offering up information about those things. And so, yeah, we are absolutely in the business of voter registration, and we're also in the business of getting out the vote and making sure that people feel confident in how they're going to be voting, what they're going to be voting on, and any other questions or things that they might have.
That's great, Tom. Well, I'm kind of running out of time. On that note, I want to thank you, Tom Bergen, for making time for me today. And please tell my listeners how they can learn more about Headcount.
Yeah, absolutely. So Headcount is a nationwide organization, so there's a good chance that we have a community that is active at least somewhat close to you where you can get out and register to vote at a show or register voters at a show. The best way to learn about us is by finding us online. Headcount.org is our website. We also have social media that you can find us on. And I think the biggest thing that I'll leave you with, Lou, is that the voter registration deadline in Florida is coming up in 41 days on October 5th. So if you are not registered to vote, please make sure you register to vote by October 5th. And then, of course, Election Day is November 3rd this year. So put those two dates in your calendar. Head on over to headcount.org for any other voting information you need or to sign up to be a volunteer. And, yeah, get excited for the 2026 midterms.
Beautiful. Thanks again, Tom. You have a great day.
Absolutely. You as well. Bye-bye.
A new website lets you learn if you've been part of a flock search. The national debate over flock safety's license plate reader technology has turned a website built by a former software engineer into a sensation. Hundreds of thousands of people a day are visiting Have I Been Flocked, the database created October 2025 by Chris Van Pelt as he grew disillusioned with the tech industry. It's exploded over the past week, Van Pelt told Business Insider last week, providing screenshots of traffic data that showed the site peaked at 60,000 unique visitors every 2 hours. Flock's technology is used in more than 6,000 communities across 49 states, according to the company, and has been credited with helping police solve serious crimes and find suspects. It's also sparked fresh discourse about police surveillance, and Have I Been Flocked was caught in the right place at the right time. It lets users plug in any vehicle's license plate and check it against a limited database of flock safety audit logs. Van Pelt, who has left tech and enrolled in law school at the University of Iowa, said his goal was to show people not only how prevalent these systems are, but how often and how unrestricted their use is. The site does not show whether a car was snapped by a Flock camera. Instead, it can show whether a Flock customer, like a police agency or a private company, has searched for a specific license plate number. The site warns that its data is incomplete. It aggregates a patchwork of audit logs, including records published by agencies themselves and by others released in response to public records requests. The database now contains more than 242 million recorded searches dating back to November 2021, according to the site. Van Pelt said the site is part of a broader grassroots effort of people pushing back against Flock cameras in their communities. Volunteers, particularly members of the Flock Discord community, have filed public records requests, answer users' questions, and point people towards additional resources. The site says it relies on donations streaming through the Alternative News Weekly Foundation, a nonprofit that supports independent watchdog journalism. Van Pelt said it takes about $50 to $100 to run the servers each month. Flock Safety has become a national lightning rod. The Atlanta-based company, which was valued at $8.4 billion in April, is best known for its automated license plate reader technology, which combines cameras off perched atop intersections with advanced search features. Cameras capture physical descriptions of vehicles, including license plate numbers, make and model, paint color, and dents or scratches, and compile them into a AI data-driven database. The readers have come under increasing scrutiny amid allegations of misuse and inaccuracy. In early August, the Washington Post reported at least 50 law enforcement officers across the U.S. had been accused of misusing license plate scanning tech to track unknowing drivers. Flock cameras were used in 46 of those cases. In March, Business Insider reported on multiple circumstances in which innocent drivers were pulled over, stopped at gunpoint, bitten by a police dog, or jailed after Flock technology misread license plates. Flock announced a series of changes in mid-August aimed at addressing concerns about privacy and misuse, including shortening its recommended data retention period for new customers from a month to a week, and introducing additional tools designed to flag potentially improper searches. Those changes haven't satisfied all of Flock's critics. In a statement, the ACLU called Flock's recent changes a thinly veiled PR attempt to counter communities' genuine privacy concerns with its mass surveillance system. Controversies have also fueled growing network of citizen-run projects to monitor the technology, including DFlock and Flock Hopper. Have I Been Flocked is quickly emerging as one key tool that surveil the surveillance tech ecosystem. Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson suggested that her colleagues let themselves be manipulated by the Trump administration when the conservative majority on August 24th agreed with the president that a challenge to his crackdown on mail-in ballots was premature. Rather than swallow the government's gamesmanship whole, Jackson argued in her scathing dissent, the court should have rejected the administration's bad faith request to lift the court order blocking implementation of the policy before the midterm elections. Instead, Jackson said, the court lets another shoe drop in the Kafkaesque nightmare that is our precedents that have been steadily created for certain plaintiffs who seek to bring election-related challenges. Taking its eye off the ball, the majority misses the government's actual objective to secure our impetus for its effort to foment chaos ahead of the November elections, she wrote. It's not the first time Jackson has complained that her colleagues are weighing the scales of justice differently depending on who is asking for help. earlier this year, Jackson warned that the court looking too partisan in a decision about congressional maps. 2025, she said the court was sending a troubling message that it's departing from basic legal standards for the administration. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Thanks to Tom Bergen for joining us this week.